Good morning, and welcome to the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for today, Friday, July 22nd. I'm your reader, Cynthia Pokornar Martinez, and we'll start off with the first article on the front page. Iowans place record bets. Casinos, sports books face new competition, slowing economy, and this is by Tom Barton. Iowa gamblers placed a record amount of bets online and in person on both casino and sports games in the last fiscal year, with wagers topping $4 billion, an average of nearly $11 million a day. Iowa's 19 state-licensed casinos reported adjusted gross revenue of nearly $1.78 billion from slot machines and table games and a separate sports wagering handle of more than $2.4 billion that netted them nearly $140 million in receipts for the 12-month period ending June 30th, Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission data shows. That was the highest year on record in terms of adjusted gross revenue, said Brian Orilko, the commissioner's administrator. Casinos posted strong numbers during the first part of the fiscal year, from July through December and into January, as the Iowa and U.S. economies rebounded and the state relaxed and eventually ended COVID-19 public health mitigation measures. Iowa casinos saw increased attendance, which had not been the case for the last several years. Casinos saw more than 17.4 million admissions in fiscal 22, up 6.5% from the previous fiscal year, but still down from 22.8 million through the turnstiles during the record year of fiscal 2012. And the article goes on to say, Wes Eckrick, president and chief executive officer of the Iowa Gaming and Association, an umbrella group for the licensed casinos in Iowa, attributed the increase in revenues and admissions to pent-up demand during the pandemic and the public viewing Iowa's casinos as premier entertainment destinations where they felt comfortable and safe during the pandemic. The increased betting action proved profitable for the state, with casinos paying over $349 million in state taxes on gambling at their facilities and $9.6 million in state taxes on sports betting proceeds. It's a lot of money. In addition to casinos, state proceeds from lottery profits stood at $89.7 million on nearly $400 million in sales through May. The Iowa Lottery Authority expected to issue its 12-month financial data next month, a revised total that will push overall gambling in Iowa for fiscal 2022 well above $4.2 billion. Casino betting, however, has cooled in the last 3 months, as the cost of fuel and goods and services have soared, with inflation hitting a 40-year high and putting a strain on households' budgets. Admissions to Iowa casinos and adjusted gross receipts fell the last 3 months compared with the same period last year. Casino admissions in the fourth quarter of fiscal 2022, April through June this year, were 13% below the average admissions for all fourth quarters since 2010. It is not possible to determine whether admissions in the future will rebound or whether a new normal can be expected, according to this latest report from the state's Fiscal Services Division. Eric said the revenues will be tough to replicate, but show a robust gaming industry in Iowa that people enjoy coming to. He and Orilko, though, note Iowa casinos face headwinds in the coming fiscal year from a slowing economy and out-of-state competition. Nebraska officials last year approved rules for casinos to operate in the state and ground was broken last week on a temporary casino at the Lincoln Racecourse with hopes to open in September, the Lincoln Journal Star reported. Companies have also announced plans for casinos in Omaha and South Sioux City in Nebraska and Hastings, Minnesota. Earlier this year, the Iowa legislature barred regulators from issuing any more casino licenses in the state for 2 years, blocking for now another attempt to win approval of a casino in Cedar Rapids. Sports betting. But while casino betting has cooled for now, sports betting remains hot in Iowa. More than $2.4 billion was wagered in the state for the fiscal year ending in June, nearly double that of the prior fiscal year. More than 90%, or $2.2 billion, of sports bets were placed using online apps for the 2022 fiscal year, compared with $985 million in online wagers for the fiscal year ending June 30th. Of 2021. An Iowa law initially required players to first register in person at a casino to wager on sports, but players have been able to sign up for sports books over electronic devices starting in January 2021 and then place bets from anywhere in Iowa. Well, that threw the door open for sports betting in Iowa, and numbers have rocketed to records since then, said Russ Mitchell, an analyst for playia.com. You could literally sign up for 18 different sports books right now and compare odds from one sports book to another and maximize your success that way. That really ramped up the advertisement. That's why you saw a lot of DraftKings and FanDuel ads offering free play dollars and promotional credits. Oh. And inflation doesn't appear to be putting much of a dent in Iowa's sports betting habits. Even with the seasonal summer slowdown and the absence of football and basketball on which to bet, Iowa keeps setting new sports betting benchmarks, Mitchell said. Iowa casinos and their sportsbook partners collected $122.4 million in sports bets for the month of June. A 10% increase from June a year ago. Let me just repeat that. This is pretty astounding. Iowa casinos and their sportsbook partners collected $122.4 million in sports bets for the month of June. That's a 10% increase over last year. And casinos and sportsbooks should see an uptick in August, followed by an even larger increase in September with the return of NFL and college football, Mitchell said. Tom Coates, the executive director of a Des Moines credit counseling service and a leading gambling critic in Iowa, worries about the societal cost of the state's $4 billion plus appetite for gambling. The Iowa Problem Gambling Services Program with the State Department of Public Health reported more contacts last year from people seeking gambling problem referrals, with casino table games and slot machines primarily cited, followed by lottery and sports wagering. Updated numbers on contacts to Your Life Iowa for gambling-related issues were not immediately available Wednesday. Coates worries the state will see a growing percentage of Iowans, particularly younger Iowans, developing gambling addictions due to the ease, prevalence, and popularity of sports betting, where individuals can gamble from home using a credit card. He said casino operators realize they need to move towards sports and online games that attract younger clients, and which can be highly addictive because that's where their bread and butter is. Orilko, his name is spelled O-H-O-R-I-L-K-O, Orilko, from the Racing and Gaming Commission encouraged gamblers to take advantage of tools to limit their online betting, Iowa requires casinos and sports betting companies to create tools that allow individuals to place their own restrictions on how much they gamble. Such limits are voluntary for gamblers. Responsible gambling is very important for the commission, and I believe for the operators as well, O'Orilko said. And that's that article. And we'll return here to the front page, and there's a delightful photo. It's a big color one of a mother holding up her young son, and they're in the swimming pool. And the caption below says, Valerie Lovelady, right, plays with her son, Axton, too, while spending the afternoon swimming at Pirate Cove Water Park on Wednesday, July 20th. The City of Council Bluffs is hosting a community summer party at its other public pool, Cattleman Water Park, 1230 16th Avenue, from 6:15 to 8:15 p.m. on Friday, July 29th. That would be a week from today. The theme for the pool party is Retro Night, and the event will feature games, prizes, and a 60s and 70s music playlist. The concession stand will be selling root beer floats, and a taco truck will be parked outside serving up dinner. The cost is only $5 per person. So that sounds like a good plan. And there's another picture below the one where the mother was holding up her young son. And there's two little tykes splashing in the water next to some structure at the water park. And it's Xander Glenn. He's 21 months. And his cousin, Mason Glenn, 3, play in the kiddie pool. Sure makes you want to go cool off in a pool. Okay, so this next article is Ernst calls for stricter immigration. Comments follow visit to U.S. southern border last week. And this is an article by Caleb McCullough of the Quad City Times. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, called for a return to Trump-era border policies in a press conference with other Republican senators on Wednesday. Ernst was among Republican senators led by Senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, on a visit to the U.S. southern border last week, where the senators joined Customs and Border Protection agents and law enforcement on various duties. The senators slammed President Joe Biden's administration for changes made to border enforcement, including Biden's lifting of former President Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, which forced U.S. Asylum seekers to stay in Mexico while their cases were resolved in U.S. immigration courts. The U.S. Supreme Court greenlit Biden's decision to lift the policy in a late June decision after it was blocked by a federal judge. Ernst called the situation on the visit infinitely worse than what she'd encountered on previous visits to the border. She criticized President Joe Biden's implementation of alternatives to detention policies, which allow migrants to be released from detention while they await immigration court proceedings. This administration continues to encourage these dangerous journeys with their catch-and-release open-door border policy, she said. Ernst and U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, called for scrutinization of alternatives to detention policies this week. The American Civil Liberties Union contends the policy is more humane and cost-effective compared to detention. Encounters with migrants at the southwest border reached a record high in May with more than 240,000 encounters, according to the Department of Homeland Security, and they fell slightly in June. Encounters have been higher this fiscal year than the previous 3 years, according to the department's data. Senators at the press conference also criticized Biden's attempt to lift Title 42, a public health measure put in place by Trump allowing border agents to quickly expel migrants, including asylum seekers. A Louisiana judge blocked Biden from lifting this rule in May. Immigration activists and public health officials have criticized Title 42, saying immigration is not a source of pandemic spread and calling it a human rights violation. Ernst said the situation at the border was a humanitarian crisis, as she and other senators noted instances of sexual assault that women and girls suffer in attempting to cross the border, and the rates of illicit drugs such as fentanyl being smuggled from Mexico to the United States. When is this administration going to wake up and say, stop coming here, don't take this dangerous journey, Ernst said. When are they going to change their policies? And back to a quick return to the front page, the other article at the bottom says, housing, roads top ARPA needs. Survey of county residents ranks where they'd like to see funds distributed. And there's a photo of a meeting of the Pottawatomie County residents at the Council Bluffs Public Library for a town hall meeting regarding the allocation of funds for the county's next round of federal COVID-19 relief money on May 4th. Affordable housing, rental assistance, and improved roads are three of Pottawatomie County residents' top issues they would like to see addressed with the next round of COVID relief funds, according to survey results recently presented to the Board of Supervisors by a local community organizing group. And this is an article by David Golbitz of the Nonpareil newspaper. Affordable housing, rental assistance, and improved roads are three of Pottawatomie County residents' top issues they would like to see addressed with the next round of COVID relief funds, according to survey results recently presented to the Board of Supervisors by a local community organizing group. We recognize the unprecedented significance of ARPA money allocation, $9 million. Group member Doug Irwin said at the July 12th board meeting, this group recognized the need in soliciting direct resident feedback. We thought, this is such a big amount, we need to talk to the residents of Pottawatomie County and find out how they think things should be spent. The local group, the Concerned Citizens of Pottawatomie County, partnered with United Today, Stronger Tomorrow, a nonprofit organization created to assist communities recover from the COVID pandemic, to create and disseminate the survey and collect and collate the results. The survey consisted of 46 questions about a variety of issues that were impacted by the pandemic, including education, infrastructure, healthcare, housing, and childcare. Responses were grouped by zip code to determine any differences between urban and rural residents. Responses from urban communities made up about 2/3 of the responses, with rural communities making up the other 1/3. With about 400 survey responses and responses collected at three town halls held around the county in April and May, results were divided into three categories and ranked according to which issues garnered the most support. In addition to providing the results of the survey, the coalition's presentation also broke down how each of the top 10 issues highlighted by participants would fit into U.S. Treasury Department guidelines for American Rescue Plan Act dollars. The second round of ARPA funding can be used for projects that fall under one of seven categories: public health, negative economic impacts, private revenue loss, premium pay for essential workers, water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure, administrative, and services for disproportionately impacted communities. Looking at both the survey results and where they could fit in the Treasury Department guidelines, the coalition revealed its top 10 list of needs, and those are as follows. Number one, public health, vaccination availability. Number two, prevention in congregate settings. Number three, PPE availability. Number four, public health payroll costs. Number five, small business economic assistance. Number six, aid to nonprofits. Number seven, affordable housing support. Number eight, community-based or community health workers of benefit navigator. Oh no, excuse me, community health workers or benefit navigators, number 9, violence interventions, and number 10, broadband last mile projects. Education also ranked highly in the results, but school districts receive their own ARPA funding and are not eligible for funds from this round of assistance. After listing the top results, Irwin laid out some next steps that the coalition would like the board to consider, such as identifying programs and partners across the county that are working in the various areas listed above that the county could work with to implement the improvements. The coalition also recommends that the county survey its residents twice a year going forward to keep a pulse on their needs. And I'm gonna, as we're flipping the page here, we're on the behind page 1 and my favorite article, Face of the Day. And this is Scruffy. He's a cute little doggy. And the article reads, while Scruffy the dog will be enjoying the air conditioning at Midlands Humane Society, shelter staff members are reminding pet owners to keep your pets cool and hydrated as the heat wave continues. Scruffy is a 4-year-old female Jack Russell Terrier mix who is currently available for adoption at Midlands. She's described as a laid-back little lady who is looking for a quiet forever home she can have all to herself. She's looking for a couch buddy to snuggle on as she naps. Her adoption fee is $250, which includes altering a microchip and age-appropriate vaccines. In other shelter news, Midlands has announced that its annual Wags and Wheels car show fundraiser will take place on August 28th. It will be the 5th year for the event, and people should keep an eye out for details in the near future. Wags and Wheels takes place in the Thunder Bowl parking lot, which will be filled with local entry classic cars and other cool rides. Some furry friends like Scruffy might even be there looking for a family. Those looking to register a vehicle or sponsor the event, please contact Midlands Director of Development and Marketing, Corey Nelson, and she is at KNELSON at MidlandsHumaneSociety.org. For more information, you also may call 712-396-2270. Again, 712-396-2270. And I'll just read this short little article here. Mega Millions jackpot, now worth $660 million, nation's ninth largest prize in Des Moines. Lottery officials on Thursday raised the Mega Millions grand prize to $660 million, giving players a shot at what would be the nation's ninth largest jackpot. The jackpot for Friday night's drawing has grown so large because there hasn't been a winner in 3 months. Those 27 consecutive drawings without anyone matching all 6 numbers has allowed the jackpot to gradually grow from its $20 million starting point in April. Even as the big prize has increased, the odds of winning all that money have remained the same. A staggering 1 in $302.5 million. The highlighted pre-tax $660 million prize is for a winner who takes an annuity option paid out in 30 annual payments. Most players choose the cash option, which for Friday's drawing would be $376.9 million. Mega Millions is played in 45 states, as well as Washington, D.C. and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The game is overseen by state lottery officials. Here's another article on Behind Page 1. It's Reynolds continues to dominate fundraising out of Des Moines. The money in Iowa's campaign for governor continues to flow in Republican incumbent Kim Reynolds' favor. Reynolds more than doubled the fundraising by Democratic challenger Deidre DeGeer over the most recent state reporting period, state campaign fundraising documents show. Candidates for office in Iowa were required to file campaign fundraising documents on Tuesday. Reynolds' campaign reported raising just more than $633,000 from May 28th to July 14th. And DeGere's campaign reported raising just shy of $256,000. This continues the overall trend of Iowa's campaign for governor. Since last year, Reynolds' campaign has raised more than $5.8 million, while DeGere's, who formally entered the race in mid-August, has raised $1.4 million. Reynolds finished the reporting period with more than $5.2 million in her campaign account, while DeGere was sitting on just more than $503,000. A recent MediaCom / Des Moines Register Iowa poll showed Reynolds with a 17-point lead over DeGere. Rick Stewart, the Libertarian Party's candidate for governor, raised $4,700 in the recent reporting period and has raised $18,000 this year. Attorney General. In what could be the most competitive races of his long career, Democratic Attorney General Tom Miller, the longest-serving state attorney general in the United States history, raised $345,000 during the recent period and has raised roughly $529,000 this year. Republican challenger Breanna Byrd, a former legal counsel to then-Governor Terry Branstad, raised $166,000 in the recent period, which lagged Miller. But she has outraised Miller this year with her total of $714,000. Miller finished the recent reporting period with $576,000 in his campaign, and Byrd had $566,000. Treasurer Mike Fitzgerald, who also holds the national record for longest serving in his state office, is being outraised exponentially by his Republican challenger, State Senator Roby Smith, Republican out of Devonport. Fitzgerald raised just more than $4,000 during the recent reporting period and has raised roughly $26,000 this year. Smith, meantime, raised more than $86,500 this period and has raised more than $165,000 this year. Other state offices, incumbents appear to be holding the fundraising cards in other statewide office campaigns. Democratic State Auditor Rob Sand is dominating the fundraising. He has raised more than $400,000 this year, while Republican challenger Todd Halber has raised only $9,000. Sand previously toyed with running for governor, but the $400,000 raised in 2022 all came after he announced his decision to run for another term as auditor. Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate, the state's top elections official, has raised more than $20,000 for his campaign, while Democratic challenger and Linn County Auditor Joel Miller has raised only roughly $5,500. John Norwood, the Democratic challenger in the state agricultural secretary campaign, has raised a solid $41,000, but that trails Republican incumbent Mike Nague, who has raised nearly $89,000. Well, that's the way that shapes up. We are going to switch over to obituaries. You're listening to the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for today, Friday, July 22nd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And we'll, just one moment, let's skip over to the obituary. And we're on for obituaries. This is for Jerry L. Cook. Age 86, of Missouri Valley, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, July 19th, with his wife of 65 years by his side. Jerry was born September 14th, 1935, in Mondamin, Iowa, to Ina Burkhart McClanahan. Jerry joined the United States Navy at 17 and served for nearly 4 years in the Korean War. He enjoyed playing baseball to blow off steam during that time. After the Navy, he began working at Griffin Pipe, where he dedicated 33 and a half years. At the same time, he cared for his farm and enjoyed spending time riding his horses. He rode horses with his grandkids and showed his team of ponies in local parades. He made every sporting event of his sons that he could. Additionally, he enjoyed watching his sons compete at the racetrack. He was also an avid bowler and traveled all over the United States with his wife for tournaments. He married Patsy Fellows on June 30th, 1957. To this union, three children were born. He is preceded in death by his mother, Ina Burkhart McClanahan, and grandson, Alex Cook. He is survived by his wife, Patsy Cook, son, Dennis, and spouse, Lori Cook, Dale and spouse, Lisa Cook, Jerry and spouse, Kim Cook, grandchildren, Jared, John, and Josh Cook, Tyler and spouse, Chelsea, and Leslie Cook, and Colton and spouse, Abby Cook, Lexi and spouse, Noah Myler, and Ashlyn and spouse, Creighton Cook, great-grandchildren, Coraline, Mirabelle, and Royce Cook. Visitation will be Thursday from 5 to 7 at Hennessy Funeral Home in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Funeral service 10 a.m. Friday, July 22nd at the Hennessy Funeral Home, Missouri Valley. Final resting place, Rose Hill Cemetery in Missouri Valley, Iowa. We're headed on over to the sports section. This is an article about prep baseball, district baseball teams released, and it's written by Austin Heinen. The Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association has released their all-district teams for classes 1A through 4A. In class 1A, tri-center pitcher Sean McGee, utility player Justice Weirs, and outfielder Michael Turner all made the Southwest First District team. Catcher Jackson Johnson and second baseman Alex Corrin made the second All-Southwest District team. Also making the Southwest second All-District team from St. Albert was catcher Dan McGrath and outfielder DJ Weilig. Finally, from AHSTW, Nick Denning made the second team as a pitcher. Riverside's Grady Jeppesen was listed as an honorable mention. In Class 2A, Underwood pitcher Jack Van Fossen was named to the Class 2A Southwest First District team, and outfielder Mason Boothby also earned first-term team honors. He earned first-term honors for the Eagles. Pitcher Jackson Schumacher also received first-time honors. On the second team, Underwood's shortstop Garrett Lewitt and outfielders Jake Reimer and Clayton Lewitt also earned honors. Trainer utility player Caden Snyder was also named to the second team. In Class 3A, Lewis Central pitcher J.C. Dermody, catcher Britton Bond, and utility player Aaron Harrington were named to the Southwest First District team. Glenwood shortstop Caden Anderson and outfielder Jamie Fritz also received first team honors. On the 3A Southwest second team, catcher Casey Clare, second baseman Peyton Fort, outfielder Devin Naylor, and utility player Ty Thompson were given honors. Glenwood's third baseman Trent Patton also made the list. In Class 4A, Abraham Lincoln pitcher Zach Lincoln, third baseman Aiden Martin, outfielder Braden Lincoln, and utility player Griff Rarden, all made the Southwest First District team for the Lynx. Catcher Garrett Denman from Thomas Jefferson was also named to the district's first team. On the second team, AL's first baseman Bennett Olson, outfield Joey Pedraza, and utility player Gavin Goldsbury made the list. For TJ, outfielder Tyler Huey and second baseman Sam Shano received honors. Congratulations to all the area players who were honored to these all-district teams. And I'm going to go ahead and read the next article. There's a photo of Kentucky running back Chris Rodriguez Jr. carrying the ball as an Iowa linebacker, Justin Jacobs, pursues him during the first half of the Hawkeyes Citrus Bowl game on New Year's Day. Challenges keep Jacobs motivated. In Iowa City, a year ago at this time, Justin Jacobs had questions, untested but feeling like he was gaining an understanding of what he could do at linebacker for the Iowa defense. Jacobs was just waiting for his chance. He had started one game in the abbreviated 2020 season, but looked for more, and last fall he delivered in 8 starts for the Hawkeyes. Until you get out there and get a chance to compete, there are always questions in the back of your mind about whether you are ready for it or not, Jacob said. It's a big jump from high school to college, a big step up. But the more I played, the more I saw that I was ready. The 6'4", 238-pound Englewood, Ohio native finished his sophomore season with 53 tackles. He forced a fumble that led to a touchdown in Iowa's win at Iowa State and intercepted a pass that led to a field goal drive in the Hawkeyes' victory over Penn State. With each outing beside Jack Campbell and Seth Benson at outside linebacker, Jacobs gained experience and confidence. I feel like now I'm in a position to play faster, Jacobs said. Things are coming to me more instinctively, and I'm reacting quicker because I know exactly what is going on, why we are doing it, and what the expectations are. He likes his role at the outside position in the middle of the Iowa defense, a spot he shares with whoever earns the chance to replace Dane Belton as the Hawkeye starter at the cash position, the hybrid safety slash linebacker role Iowa utilizes against more wide open attacks. Jacobs welcomes whatever snaps he can get as well as the challenge that often awaits. I like the position I'm in. I've always felt like it's fun to be out in space. There are some challenges that go along with that. You get tested on almost every down. Every down, you have to be on top of it, Jacobs said. You have to be on ready, whether you are going up against a wide receiver or a tight end. That test is part of what attracts Jacobs to his role. There's a challenge in going up against different types of players, and I love that. That's the fun part of the game, Jacobs said. One snap, it might be dealing with a quick receiver. The next, a physical tight end. That's a challenge I welcome. It's a test Jacobs believes he is better equipped to deal with as he works toward the start of his junior season. He has concentrated on building his knowledge base this summer, continuing to build on that foundation to be prepared for whatever situations he might find himself dealing with during the course of a game. There are things that I've learned as I go deeper into my career, and this summer, I feel like I've been able to work on myself as an individual more, Jacob said. My knowledge of the playbook, my knowledge of our schemes, knowledge why we do certain things. Those are things I am working on. It's been a process for Jacobs, who initially selected the Hawkeyes over an offer from the Ohio State and enrolled early, but was then forced to miss spring practices because of a shoulder injury. That set him back, but Jacobs reminded himself that it was all part of a process, and strong faith and perseverance kept him moving forward. You come in and you learn that it takes time. Nothing is given. It's earned. He said his initial season at the college level was humbling at times. You have to make sacrifices for the team. That was a big thing I had to learn. It wasn't necessarily about me. Maybe my teammate was doing better than me, Jacob said. Understanding that, Jacobs returned to work. At the end of the day, you realize that if you keep putting the work in, that your day will come, Jacob said. I'd be lying if I said it was frustrating at times. I'm a competitor. I always want to be out there, but that's not always the way it works. I had to earn it, and that challenge, it motivated me. Good article. And we're going to go on with college softball. Jordan takes over softball program. And Iowa Weston Iowa Western softball enjoyed a lot of success under former head coach Ben Greer, but now enters its next stage after Iowa Western CC announced on Wednesday that Heidi Jordan would be taking over the program. Jordan most recently coached at NCAA Division II Rockhurst University in Missouri and coached at Highland Kansas Community College for 17 years before that. She went 576 to 234 at Highland and hopes to continue to find success with the Reavers. "I am so excited," she said. "Iowa Western has always been a school on my radar as a head coach. To actually have the opportunity to be a part of that coaching staff and Iowa Western's tradition is amazing. Iowa Western wins championships. That's the ultimate goal. They're not afraid to put money into their programs, and they support them well, and there's no better place to be for that." Jordan started her softball career as a pitcher when she was around 5 years old, and the love for pitching is something she brings to the diamond as a coach. "Fans of the program can expect to see that in the coming years. I am a pitcher at heart," Jordan said. "I like to have a really good pitching staff. I would say in my years of coaching, we've been known for our pitching staff being solid and everything. I love a defensive game. I love to play clean. I love to play with a lot of energy. I love passion. You might see some fist pumps. You might see some excitement out there. I just want them to go hard, play hard, and no regrets, and not even to think twice. What happens, happens. I just want the girls to put it all on the line. We like to run bases and push the envelope and challenge the other team. If we're going to be beat, they're going to have to beat us. We're not going to do it ourselves." Jordan also coached one summer with the Akron Racers, a professional team in the National Pro Fast Pitch. During her time at Highland, Jordan led her teams to 8 district championships and appeared in 8 National Junior College Athletic Association softball national tournaments. Her teams captured 5 Kansas Jayhawk Community College Conference championships and had a conference record of 281-82. Coach Jordan guided her teams to 30 or more wins 11 times, and 5 of her last 10 seasons saw 40 plus wins, including a high of 49 victories in 2012. Jordan hasn't met her team yet, but looks forward to starting to know her players when she arrives. "It's all about getting to know the team," she said. "I really want to get to know them on a personal basis first, before I get to know them on an athletic basis. Missing the recruiting process, I didn't get the chance to know any of these players, and I really think you need to know who they are as people before you know who they are as athletes. I'm really excited to get to know them that way. Plus, we can form some trust and bonds, and that just makes the whole process go a lot smoother." Ben Greer had a very successful program. "I'm super excited just to be a part of that, and I just hope to keep building on what they started." So I'm going to change it up a little and read an article here from the Lifestyles and Faith section on the Friday newspaper. "Treating Fatty Liver Disease with a Diet Change," offered by Barbara Intermill. She's a registered dietitian. "It's the most common form of liver disease in the United States and other developed countries, and it's not related to alcohol consumption. That's why it's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD, N-A-F-L-D. Just as the name implies, NAFLD, which is again the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, is an abnormal buildup of fat in the liver. Left untreated, the liver becomes more and more inflamed and can eventually progress to irreversible liver damage called cirrhosis. According to an article by registered dietitian Jill Weisenberger in Food and Nutrition magazine for nutrition professionals, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease appears more in people who are obese and or have type 2 diabetes. NAFLD is also more common if a person has one or more characteristics of a condition called metabolic syndrome, excess inches around the abdomen, high blood sugars, elevated blood pressure and blood triglycerides, and low levels of HDL, the good cholesterol. Surprisingly, or maybe it shouldn't be, the main treatment for NAFLD involves lifestyle changes to help the liver heal itself. That includes a diet that provides optimal nutrients and limited calories to lose weight. Slow and steady weight loss is best, say nutrition experts. Diets that cause a rapid loss of weight, more than 3.5 pounds per week, force large amounts of fatty acids through the liver and can actually worsen this condition, the fatty liver disease. Since non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is related to metabolic syndrome, diets that improve that condition are also effective treatments for NAFLD. One good example is the Mediterranean-style diet, which features olive oil, nuts, fish, fruit, veggies, and whole grains. This style of eating has been shown to lower fat levels in the liver. What about wine and other types of alcohol? Even though NAFLD is not related to alcohol consumption, excess booze may aggravate a fatty liver. For this reason, many experts, including the American Liver Foundation, advise those with NAFLD to completely avoid alcoholic beverages. Coffee and tea are generally okay for people with NAFLD. Limited research suggests that the anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties of these beverages may reduce the severity of fatty liver. Forget it if you drown your coffee and tea in sugar, however. Drinking sugar-sweetened beverages may increase your risk for fatty liver, say some scientists. Also be cautious with self-dosing various supplements, Weissenberger advises. Excessive hits of some herbal products are toxic to the liver. Green tea, for example, is rich in substances that may improve NAFLD. Yet concentrated doses of green tea extracts have caused liver problems in some people, according to the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. Physical activity is another effective treatment for NAFLD. Aim for a minimum of 150 minutes a week of moderate huff and puff exercise combined with a couple of stretch training sessions a week, say experts. I'm going to read one last article, and this is diesel prices squeeze truckers, farmers, and consumers. When long-haul trucker Deb LaBrie sets out on a road to deliver pharmaceuticals, she has strategies to hold down costs. She avoids the West Coast and the Northeast, where diesel prices are highest. She organizes her delivery route to minimize deadheading, meaning driving an empty truck in between deliveries. And if a customer's load is too far away or they can't pay more for fuel, she turns down the job. It breaks my heart because I either have to say, no, I can't afford to, or I can, but you're going to have to pay some of my fuel to get me there, LaBrie said. I hate doing both of those things because it's not the customer's fault. It's not our fault. The price of diesel fuel has skyrocketed in recent months, much more than regular gasoline, especially after Russia invaded Ukraine in February. Moscow's tackled numerous nations to spurn Russian fuel, removing from the market a major source of oil, the main component of diesel fuel, and driving prices drastically up. For months, motorists have felt the pain of high gasoline prices. Many may not know that they're also absorbing the impact of much costlier diesel fuel. That's because the goods consumers buy, from cereal and orange juice to Amazon deliveries of diapers, are delivered by trucks, trains, or ships that run on diesel. Those inflated prices are then passed on from company to company until they reach consumers in the form of costlier goods. People pay less attention to diesel prices because people aren't going to the pump and using it, said Matt Smith, lead oil analysis at Kpler, a research firm. But diesel has a more far-reaching impact and is already having a real big impact across the economy. Diesel fuel is averaging $5.50 a gallon nationally, up 68% from a year ago when it was selling for just $3.27. By comparison, a gallon of regular gasoline is averaging $4.47, up 41% from a year ago. High gasoline prices eased somewhat in recent weeks, but diesel has remained chronically high, with American refineries operating near capacity. Unless prices ease, the ripple effects of high diesel fuel could worsen because the costs are deterring some truck companies from accepting jobs unless they can persuade their customers to pay more for the fuel. There will be more logistical shortages, said Phil Verlinger, a longtime energy economist. Americans will find more empty shelves and higher prices. If they're not rejecting jobs, many truckers are choosing lighter loads or working longer hours to make up for money lost on fuel, according to interviews with truckers and industry executives. Farmers harvesting hay and planting corn with diesel-fired tractors are absorbing a financial hit. Delivery companies are installing their own fuel pumps to cut costs. Ultimately, consumers are left bearing the burden. If you're a farmer, then your energy costs are higher, and therefore it's costing more to produce grain. And that's pushing the price of grain up, and that's pushing the price of food up, said Smith, the analyst at Kpler. Even more than gasoline, high diesel prices are magnifying the cost of goods because the delivery cost has risen so much. Consumer prices soared 9.1% in June, compared with 12 months earlier, the government reported this last week. The fuel oil portion of the consumer price index nearly doubled from the same time last year. Those energy costs are working their way into all manner of different consumer products, Smith noted. One reason why diesel prices haven't yet declined as gasoline has is that OPEC nations slowed their supply of oil, and Middle East oil typically produces more diesel fuel than, say, parts of Texas do. Another factor is that China reduced its diesel exports, presumably to help achieve its net zero greenhouse gas emissions goals. Within the United States, refineries that produce diesel from crude oil are essentially maxed out. The nation has 11 fewer refineries operating today than before the pandemic, according to the American Petroleum Institute. One refinery that had served the East Coast closed after an explosion in 2019 and never reopened. And some refineries in California are closed for retrofitting to process renewable fuel. We use a lot of diesel, probably more than what these refineries can produce, said Bob Costello, chief economist of the American Trucking Associations. President Joe Biden's visit last week to Saudi Arabia was intended in part to encourage OPEC to produce more oil, which would mean more diesel fuel globally. Though no major deal was announced, Prince Mohammed bin Salman hinted that Saudi Arabia could potentially produce more oil. But expecting OPEC to export more oil during high demand summer months might be unrealistic, said Amy Myers Jaffe, an energy expert at Tufts University. The important thing, she says, is to make sure that our allies, together with OPEC, don't decrease any flows to the market at any junction, especially if we have some kind of disruption. Well, folks, that does it for today's reading of the Daily Nonpareil for Friday, July 22nd. I've been your reader, Cynthia Pokorna Martinez, You can access a reading of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening, and have a peaceful weekend.